In 1989, The Dead Poets Society was released in theaters. The story takes place at Welton Academy, an elite traditional all-boys school in Vermont, and it touts its four pillars: honor, tradition, discipline, and excellence. Welton, referred to by the students as Helton, was a strict, no-nonsense environment. In the midst of this beige boredom enters Mr. John Keating, our energetic, whimsical protagonist played by the late, great Robin Williams. Mr. Keating, a former Welton student himself, had made it his mission to not let this passionless institution lead these men to live half-hearted lives. He, in one of the opening scenes, when he kind of meets the boys and he kicks off his English literature class, 19th century English literature, he starts out with this. Thank you, Chris. You're the man. No, it's fine. We're going to make it work. He starts out with this. Fellas, words and ideas can change the world. I can see what you may be thinking. 19th century literature has nothing to do with going to business school or medical school. We should simply study the subject and go quietly about the business of achieving other ambitions. Well, I have a little secret for you. And then he calls the boys. He says, huddle up, huddle up. We don't read and write poetry because it's cute. We read and write poetry because we are members of the human race, and the human race is filled with passion. Medicine, law, business, engineering, these are noble pursuits and necessary to sustain life. But poetry, beauty, romance, love, these are what we stay alive for. And the boys are captivated. Finally, someone who loves them, someone who has vision for their lives, someone who dares for them to live full lives with their whole hearts. One of risk, yes, but one of adventure. I think that this is a worthy comparison. It pales in comparison to today's reading, but I think it's a worthy comparison to show you what Jesus is doing in this passage. Jesus, in the backdrop of passionless religious systems or surface level living, Jesus steps onto the scene and he says these words: do not work for food that spoils, but for food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you. For on him, God the Father has placed his seal of approval. In this moment, with religious systems on one side and with the shadow of the Roman Empire on the other side, in steps Jesus, the color in the midst of the beige and the gray. And it's finally someone who has vision for their lives, someone who dares to invite them to live full lives with their whole hearts. Let me ask you, is this how you view Jesus? Is this how you view Jesus? Or let's ask it this way. Is this how people view the mission of the church? Is this how people view us? Or have we become Helton Academy when we were meant to be heaven on earth? What has happened to us that we would take this man, a man that men quit their jobs for, the man that people tore holes in roofs for, the man that dying women crawled through crowds for, the man that kids jumped for joy for, the man that Jewish religious leaders and Roman military leaders feared and conspired to destroy. Have we taken that man and had the audacity to make him boring? How have we taken this movement that Acts 17 says, quote, turned the world upside down, and made it a weekend meeting that serves as an optional add-on to our lives? What happened? I think it revolves around this, that you don't believe that your passion, your hunger, your love, your joy, your delight, and your pleasure belong in the presence of Jesus. Like, you don't believe that you can carry your passion, your hunger, your love, your joy, your delight into the presence of Jesus and into the mission of Jesus. You believe that this is a place of good morals, traditional values, and religious restriction. And what is required to follow Jesus is actually to shut your heart off and dial your passion down. And so what ends up happening is that we tend to do two things, is that either one, we live in the world with passion and intensity Monday through Saturday, and we have ambition and intentionality, but then we come to church and pretend to be someone else and settle for something less, and we shut our hearts off and simply just try to be a good person. Or two, we look at the world with bitterness and resentment, but all the while lusting after the things it offers underneath the surface, claiming that we don't want them, but beneath is a growing monster that is getting closer and closer to doing whatever it takes to get just a taste. And I think there's so many Christians that are living in these two realities. They're showing up, they're good people, but they shut their heart off because they don't believe it has a place in the kingdom. Or they have passion, they have intensity, but they look at the world with lustful eyes, all the while resenting it for having what they crave. And this is what I want us to get to this morning, is that vision, ambition, desire, passion, these are the things that God has given you. And these are the things that are the keys to the access that you long for when it comes to the life you crave and the relationship with Jesus you long for. That these actually belong in the kingdom of heaven, that these are actually the currency of our relationship with Jesus. The very things that so many people think they have to shut their heart off from are the very things that Jesus wants you to bring into his presence and find satisfied and fulfilled by him. Vision, ambition, desire, passion. This is what this passage is about. So I want to ask three quick questions. One, what is desire? Where does our desire come from? And what does God want to do with our desires? What is desire? Where does our desire come from? And what does God want to do with our desires? First and foremost, what is desire? The Greek word commonly used throughout the New Testament is epithumia. And it literally translates to desire or longing. And the picture that it paints is a longing for or a passion. And the illustration that could use is that of hunger. Someone that is hungering, longing, desiring for these things. Now, epithumia is commonly translated in two different ways. One, in a very positive way that paints the picture of someone who's hungering and longing after God with a heart of devotion. And then that of lust, worldly lust, craving the things of this world. But epithumia itself, desire itself, is a neutral term that can either be good or bad, positive or negative, depending on where you're taking that desire. So if the picture is that of hunger, what is hunger? Well, hunger is simply the physical sensation of wanting food and or the condition of having a lack of access to sufficient nutritious food, right? If the picture that it's painting is hunger and the picture that Jesus is using here is hunger, then what is hunger? Well, hunger is lack. Lack. The question is, where do we take that lack? Where do we take that hunger? And is it sufficient to give you what you ultimately need? Is or are you taking your hunger to some place that you have access to, but does not give you the sufficient nutritious food that you long for? So this epithumia can be positive or it can be destructive depending on where you take it, but it's natural. It's natural. And this is the launching pad of Jesus' teaching here in John chapter 6, is a conversation around desire, of hunger, of longing. So let's put it in context real quick. One, Jesus has just fed the 5,000. So if you look back just a little bit in this chapter, Jesus feeds the 5,000. It's one of his most well-known miracles. And they call it the feeding of the 5,000, but in actuality, it's 5,000 men. Now, we don't know if it was only men or if these men represented families, but he fed at least 5,000 people with just a few loaves of bread and a couple of fish. And he multiplied that and feeds these people. And it's a miracle. And now Jesus crosses a lake and, you know, go figure, people chase him and pursue him and try to get to where he is. And Jesus tells them, you are looking for me, not because you saw the signs I performed, but because you ate the loaves and had your fill. So he's telling them, he's going, you actually don't want me because you saw something about me and you believe in me. What you're wanting is the food that I gave you, that I satisfied your stomach. And so now you want me to continue to satisfy your stomach. So they're seeing Jesus as a means to an end. Remember, they're still not sure who Jesus is. They're seeing him do some amazing things and they know he's something special, but they don't know who exactly he is, which is kind of the whole point that we've been talking about with this series, is who is Jesus? Who do people say that he is? Who is he actually? Who is he trying to reveal himself to be? But they're hungry and they see this man as at least a miracle worker that just gave them a solid meal. And now they can use him to get what they need. So this is the idea of like, okay, we're hungry, we're poor. We're in captivity to a Roman Empire. This person just fed us food in abundance and said there was leftovers. And they said, we can keep coming to him and he will keep us fed and sustain us for this. And in this passage, you keep hearing them talk about manna, talking about your fathers and manna. What are they talking about? Well, they're talking about the story of the Exodus, where Moses leading the Israelites out of captivity in Egypt, and they roam around the desert for 40 years. And one of the ways that that God sustains them while they are in the desert is he gives them manna to eat. It's one of their greatest miracles. And they needed something to simply sustain their bodies for the travel. So God gives them manna from heaven. And it was a great miracle of a loving God to feed and sustain his people. It's great. But Jesus is actually trying to lift their eyes to see something greater. He's saying that there's more than what you're settling for. And if you can just get your eyes above your stomach, you'll see that I have more for you. You'll see it. But you can't get your eyes above your stomach. You're settling for less. You're settling for manna from heaven that sustains your bodies. But I'm trying to give you something more if you'll just get your eyes up to see the more that I have for you. See, but the context of this, the people are stuck in two different worlds and living in two different realities and two different stories. On one hand, they're living in a Jewish story. They were God's people awaiting God's Messiah to rescue them and restore them. But on the other hand, they're also living in a Roman story. The Roman Empire had taken over Israel. Now it was subject to the emperor as a province of Rome. And what was happening is that they were mixing these stories together. They're awaiting a Messiah who would be an earthly king and warrior like David, who would conquer Rome and set them free. And they were too earthly minded and they were missing heaven's agenda and they couldn't see past their stomachs. We see this over and over and over again. We saw it a few weeks ago in the conversation with Peter. Peter says, "You're the Messiah, the Son of the living God. You're the hero of God's story." In the very next passage, Jesus says, "Because I'm that Messiah who's come to reconcile you to God and make a way for you to have eternal life, I've got to go to the cross. I'm going to die, but I'm going to raise again." Peter gets over there, rebukes Jesus, and says, "Jesus, you got to stop talking like this." And Jesus says, "You got to get behind me." And he calls him Satan. He says, "You got to get behind me, Satan. You're thinking about worldly things, not God things." And this is what happens over and over and over again, is they look at Jesus, but they're looking at him through the world's lens or looking at him through their own agenda rather than seeing him for who he is and who he's trying to reveal himself to be. And it happens to us. And what Jesus mentions in this passage is that you are settling for a bread that spoils. You notice that. He says you're settling for a bread that spoils, but I'm trying to give you bread that endures. So what is this bread from below, this bread that spoils? Well, ultimately, Jesus kind of points back to two key things as he does this. He talks about the yeast of the Pharisees, and he talks about the yeast of Herod, kind of in different spaces. But ultimately, he's talking about two different things. One is the bread of religion. The bread of religion. This is the bread of the Pharisees. This is kind of that Jewish side of the story that they're living out of. And he says that you're settling for this bread that spoils. It doesn't last. It doesn't endure. It doesn't satisfy you. And the first thing is the bread of religion. And what he's talking about are really three different aspects. And I think they all kind of connect with what we're talking about. Is that one, he's talking about the works and the systems. He's talking about like you think that the key to having life is doing more works for God and he'll approve you and give you more of himself, or he'll affirm of you because of the works that you do, or because of the ladders that you climb or the systems that you obey. And that's what he was saying, is that these religious systems, and he would constantly come against the Pharisees. Why? Because he's saying you're putting hindrances between people and God. You're putting barriers between people and God. And you're saying, hey, you've got to come and you've got to climb this ladder in order to get to God. And Jesus is saying, I am from God, sent for the people. I don't tell them to climb the ladder up to get to God. I climb the ladder down to come and make a way for them. But you're putting hindrances in the way. And there's all of these systems that are in the way, and it convinces them that they can earn or control their relationship with God. If I do X, then God has to do Y and I get Z. That's the way they think about it, because there's a systematic approach to this. I can kind of twist God's arm and manipulate him and get what I need out of it. So Jesus says, it's not the works, it's not the system. The second thing I think that we see often with religion is that there's information. I think people tend to rely and depend on information, that if I can learn enough or I can know enough, I can have control, power, and security. No one can trick me. No one can fool me. I can have it under control if I can just know enough information. And they can't be taught. They're not teachable. They can't grow. They can't learn. Jesus constantly comes up against this every single time. He says, actually in the same chapter, he looks at the Pharisees and he says, you think it's in the scriptures themselves that you have life, but the scriptures are trying to point you to me. He's saying you can't even use your information to get to where your information is trying to lead you. You think information is the goal, but I'm the goal. But the information gets in the way. because they think they can use it to control things. And then the third thing I think is experiences. And this is one that I think we can fall accustomed to today, is that we can have certain experiences that give us a taste of like euphoria. And this can happen in the church all the time, right? Is that you go to a conference, or you go to a camp, or you have a certain experience, and the rest of your life is trying to get back to that experience because that is the pinnacle of your relationship with Jesus in your mind. But it's all kind of rooted in escapism, right? You're just trying to get this experience rather than actually building a relationship that takes time and endures. And once again, the root is pleasure and comfort. So Jesus says, there's the bread of religion, but then there's also the bread of this culture, the bread of Herod, the bread of the world. And this is often kind of what we see throughout the New Testament, what we see in the early church. They really narrow these things down to three different things: money, sex, and power. Money, sex, and power. And they continue to be the root of the things that we struggle with in the world today. The idea around money, right? If I can earn enough, then I can secure myself. The reality is that so many of you today, right, underneath the surface, you're anxious about money. Tomorrow, you'll be anxious about money. You look at your kids and you're anxious about money. You look at your future, you're anxious about money. And it drives you. It controls you in so many ways because we think if I can just get enough, I can be comfortable, I can have control, and I can secure everything. And what we convince ourselves, if I can get enough of that, I can be God. And I can guarantee that I'll be okay and everything will be okay. But we know that's not the truth. Or second, sex. If I can have enough sex or find the right sexual partner, then I can finally feel satisfied. I can find or discover enough euphoria that I'll find that moment. I'll find that place. I'll find that thing. This is how you see so many people kind of rotate among sexual partners. And then you end up finding so much of the evidence that it actually leads to more and more internal destruction, more and more anxiety, more and more identity crises, more and more brokenness, more and more inability to get close and experience intimacy and love and confidence in relationships. And it's this idea, man, if I can do this, I can have pleasure. I can have enough love. I can have the comfort that I long for, or power. Power, whether it's your own power or through some other form of power. So many people try to convince themselves that if my political party can win, right, I'll be okay. The world will be okay. We'll all be okay. And what we do is we make that other form of power the enemy. They need to lose and we need to win so that we can be okay. But the reality is what? You cannot secure enough power to guarantee, to make yourself God and make sure that you're going to be okay and that everybody else is going to be okay and that your kids are going to be okay and that the world is going to be okay. You can't do it. And what Jesus is saying is that anxiety that you feel is because you are trying to eat bread that will spoil and does not satisfy and won't endure. And you're putting this pressure on it that it needs to endure and satisfy your soul. And the reality is those things cannot carry the weight of your soul or your eternal satisfaction. They can't do it. And you want them to, and they continue to disappoint you. Or maybe to even drill at home, maybe it's something really, really good, right? Like your kids. Man, I love my kid. But my kid is not responsible for my being okay, or my being happy, or my soul being content. That's not a pressure to put on him. My wife cannot carry that weight for me, and I can't carry that weight for her. There's nothing in this world that can carry the weight of my soul. And this is what Jesus is trying to get them to understand. You continue to try to eat stuff that cannot do what you want it to do. And many of us are in the same boat. And we're living two different lives according to two different stories and two different kingdoms. Maybe it's the story of the kingdom of heaven and the story of the American dream. Maybe it's the story of faithfulness and the story of comfort. Maybe it's the story of obedience to God and the story of being liked by people. And you're trying to live in these two worlds, and these two worlds can't coexist together. They just don't work. We're divided people who can't see past our stomachs. We're dominated by our hungers, and we are living misguided lives, desperately taking our hunger to whoever or whatever will give us something to eat, even if it's ultimately destroying us. The momentary relief is worth it to us, but it's so fleeting, and we end up feeling worse than we did before. Don Harold says this, and this quote every single time gets me. He says that unhappiness is this: not knowing what we really want and killing ourselves to get it. Unhappiness is not knowing what we really want deep down and killing ourselves to get it. This is the world. This is our city. This is us a lot of times. is we don't know what will really make us happy, what will really satisfy us deep down, and we're killing ourselves to go get it. And we go find something, we pick it up, thinking this is going to do it, and then it doesn't. And we're so disappointed, and we're so destroyed, because we're putting pressure on things that can't carry the weight of it. The best thing you can do is to name your desires, to name your longings, and to name your hungers. So one of the things that we can do to help us with this is to name our desire. What is your desire? Do I desire money? Do I desire sex, pleasure, accolades and accomplishment, comfort, relationships, success, applause, recognition? What do you desire? And to be able to name that thing, to just say it. Man, if I can get enough money, then I think we'll be okay. To just say it, to name that desire. If I can just get enough what, then I think I'll be okay. If I can just get recognized by this person, then I think I'll be okay. If I can just what? Name that desire. But then you really want to change your life? Ask one simple question after you name that desire. Why? It'll change your life. Why? I want recognition. Why? Why? I want success. Why? I want comfort. Why? I want relationships. Why? I want approval. Why? Because as you do this, you'll be honest with yourself. And you will realize, I'm asking this to do something for me that it cannot do. It cannot do this. See, what happens when we don't name these things is we walk out, and we're kind of drift, and we're just letting ourselves be led by an unnamed desire. But if I were to actually look at you and go, man, I want my kid to be okay. And if I know my kid is safe and okay, then I'll be okay. And go, well, why? Right? Like, is this a pressure that I'm now putting on my kid to go, man, if life hurts for you, I'm not going to be okay. And what am I telling him subconsciously? You cannot come to me with your pain because I will not be okay. Because my happiness depends on your being okay. And you go, well, I would never want my kid to think that. Exactly. That's the power of naming and asking why. Why? Because you ask that enough times, you'll say something. You'll go, well, that's not what I really think. Or that's not what I really feel. Yet that's what we're living out of. And Jesus is trying to get them to say, you're living out of a story and you're living for things that you don't really want to live out of and that you really don't want to live for. Get your eyes out. What is the thing beneath the thing that is driving everything? Your heart, biblically, is the operating center of who you are. It's the thing that's in the driver's seat. And so whatever is at the center of your heart is the thing that's driving your life. Who or what do you wake up and live this life for? When you wake up in the morning, what drives you to get up and get after it? Who or what do you find yourself thinking about the most? Driving in your car, music off, what does your mind go? These things right here, they'll reveal your real God, the one you worship, the one you fear, the one you love. However, one of the things I want you to notice in this passage is I want you to notice what Jesus does and does not condemn. Okay? This is super important. What does Jesus condemn? Jesus condemns the bread. It spoils, it perishes, it doesn't last, it doesn't satisfy. This is what Jesus says, the bread. That's what he wants to condemn. That's what he wants you to see. The bread is what he condemns. Why? He tells us it does not last and it will destroy you in the long run. So Jesus condemns the bread. Why? Because he loves you. That's why. Because Jesus actually wants you to be satisfied. He actually wants you to find fulfillment. He actually wants you to find eternal joy and pleasure and richness. Deep, not surface level, deep, lasting. And he says, I want you to understand that I'm condemning this bread because this bread's not good for you. Tim Keller says it like this, that when we treat things as more than they are meant to be, we become less than we are meant to be. That when I'm putting pressure on this bread that spoils to do for me what it cannot do, what happens is I get destroyed in the process and I become less than what I'm meant to be. Rather than bearing the image of God and being a resemblance of him, what I end up doing is I end up looking more like an animal who's just drifting and going, chasing whatever internal desires that it feels. The Bible consistently calls these things idols. Keller once again defines idols as this, that idols are often good things that become ultimate things that inevitably destroy us. And this is the bread that spoils. However, what does Jesus not condemn? This is what I want you to see. Jesus does not condemn hunger. He doesn't condemn hunger. He condemns the bread that spoils. He condemns where we take our hunger. He does not condemn hunger itself. Hunger, longing, desire, passion. He doesn't condemn them. He doesn't. He says, I've put these in you. These are good things. And here's why Jesus doesn't condemn hunger, longing, desire, or passion. It's because you are deeper than surface level things that spoil. You are more substantive than this. You are made in God's image with glimpses of eternal glory coursing through your veins, echoes and memories of another life whisper to your heart, a life in a world that you were made for, hopes of another world flash before your eyes because you are more than what this world has to offer you in and of itself. You are more, you are worth more than this bread that spoils. This is what Jesus is trying to get you to see. You're worth more than this bread that spoils. And when you settle for it, you become less than what you were meant to be. Your hunger is good. Your desire is good. Your passion is good. Your longing is good. The bread is bad. And so where do our desires and our longings come from? Gary Brashears has a great line. He says, our strongest desires are not our deepest desires. That there are things that you long for, that you desire, that you crave. But once again, if you get to the thing beneath the thing, you'll realize that you crave something deeper, even if it's not the strongest. That a lot of us, we have strong cravings. Some of us here have been addicted to things for such a long time that we just cannot break loose of. And you right now can be craving or desiring that thing that you know is not good for you and is off limits when it comes to what God says is for you. And yet we keep going after it, after it, after it. Why? Because it's giving us something. It's giving us something that we want. It's doing something for us. And what Jesus and what Brashears is saying here, and what Jesus will be saying is that, no, you got to get beneath that. What are you really longing for? Because your strongest desires are not your deepest desires. I love what John Tyson says when it talks about where do our desires and longings come from. He says this, that your desires are Edenistic, not hedonistic. They're Edenistic, not hedonistic. What's he saying in that? The Garden of Eden, right? Where God created and placed you in the very beginning. He's saying that God created you as someone with hunger and desires and longings, that this is how he's made you. This is in the fabric of your DNA. Now these are divine designs by God for how you are made to be, right? That God created you with passions and desires to live a full life and not settle for less. Now, these desires may be rerouted through sin. They may be confused and mapped onto the wrong thing sometimes, but the desire itself is not a mistake of the flesh or a ploy of the enemy. It's the design of a loving God who has not made you to be a robot. He's made you to desire. He has made you to hunger. He has made you to resist the tyranny of mediocrity and live a life of passion, meaning, and significance. So the question now leads us to is, what does God want us to do with these desires, these passions that he's given us? What do we do with our longings, with our hunger? Does God just want us to indulge them, to just release them? Don't worry about self-control, just live. I've given you these desires, and whatever you feel is good, just go after it. Does God just want us to indulge our desires? No. What about fast, to continue with that picture of hunger? Does he want us to just fast from our desires? And maybe we just kind of go in and out of living by desires. Maybe we go out throughout the week, we do what we want, but then on the weekend, we fast from those desires and we go to church, we be a good person, we read our Bible. Or maybe we fast in the morning, we intermittent fast with sin. And we fast in the morning, we do our quiet time, right? And then we go out into the world with no attention to God. Or does he want us to starve our desires? This is what a lot of people think, is that God just wants you to starve your desires. He just wants you to restrict your desires to find shallow, and you end up finding shallow substitutes. Or lastly, what you may be thinking is that God actually wants to just destroy your desires. Just make you an obedient puppet. He wants you to be nice, be a good person, but he doesn't want you to have passion, hunger, desire. Well, let me tell you, here's what God wants to do with your desires, your longings, and your affections. He wants to stir them. He wants to stir them to the point that you refuse to satisfy for less. And then he wants to fulfill them with himself. God actually wants to stir your longings, your passions, your desires, that you would not settle for less, There's so many of us, we're afraid to feel, we're afraid to long, we're afraid to hunger because we believe that they will lead us to the wrong things. But I believe that God actually wants to stir them up in such a way that we long and we hunger for something deeper than what we often settle for. In the words of C.S. Lewis, the issue isn't that we, the issue is that we are far too easily pleased, is what he said. The issue is not that we, that there, that God has, that God is not enough to fulfill our passions and our desires. The issue is that we are far too easily pleased. And he compared it. He says, you're at a beautiful beach in the background, and yet what you choose to do is play with mud pies in a dump. And he's like, turn around and feast on beauty. Stop playing with your mud pies and go to the beach. We're far too easily pleased. You see, the Christian life is not about the eradication of your desires, but the fulfillment of your desires in the one thing, the one person that can actually fulfill you both now and for eternity. Augustine says this, the entire life of a good Christian is in fact an exercise of holy desire. You do not yet see what you long for, but the very act of desiring prepares you so that when he comes, Jesus comes, you may see and be utterly satisfied. So, my brethren, let us continue to desire, for we shall be filled. Such is our Christian life. By desiring heaven, we exercise the powers of our soul. Now, this exercise will be effective only to the extent that we free ourselves from desires leading to infatuation with this world. He's saying that you are meant to be filled. You are meant to feast. You are meant to experience heavenly desire that fulfills you, that fulfills the longings of your hearts, but we are far too easily satisfied by being infatuated with the things of this world. C.S. Lewis says, God made us, invented us as a man invents an engine. A car is made to run on petrol, on gas, and it would not run properly on anything else. Now, God designed the human machine to run on himself. He himself is the fuel our spirits were designed to burn, or the food our spirits were designed to feed on. There is no other. That is why it is just no good asking God to make us happy in our own way without bothering about religion. God cannot give us a happiness and peace apart from himself because it is not there. There is no such thing. Like, you asking for God to satisfy you and make you happy apart from himself is, it's a futile prayer, because the only thing that can make you eternally happy and deeply satisfied is God himself. Psalm 63, the psalmist David writes, you, God, are my God. Earnestly I seek you. I thirst for you. My whole being longs for you in a dry and parched land where there is no water. I have seen you in the sanctuary and beheld your power and your glory. Because your love is better than life, my lips will glorify you. I will praise you as long as I live, and in your name I will lift my hands. I will be fully satisfied as with the richest of foods. With singing lips, my mouth will praise you. On my bed, I remember you. I think of you through the watches of the night. Because you are my help, I sing in the shadow of your wings. I cling to you. Your right hand upholds me. Listen to what David is saying about God. I long for you. I thirst for you. I've seen you in your glory and your power. Your love is better than life. I will praise you as long as I live. I will be fully satisfied in you as with the richest of foods. He says, I get lost in thought about you while I lay in bed. Well, while you doom scroll, David's sitting there feasting on God. He's saying, man, I can't get my mind off of you. I keep thinking about you. I cling to you. I sing to you. Let me ask you, does this sound like someone who had a slight shift in ideology? Does this sound like someone who picked up some good ideas? Does this sound like someone who read a book and thought this intellectually makes sense? No, this is someone who has had an encounter and fallen in love. That's what this is. This isn't him studying God as a subject to see if it makes sense or fits into his life. He's had an encounter with a living God and he's found himself in love. What happened to him? He tasted the bread from heaven. He tasted the bread from heaven. This is what happens to David. He tasted the bread from heaven. The very bread that Jesus himself is offering these people, the very bread that Jesus himself is offering you, David tasted that bread and found himself fully satisfied and longing for more. Tozer once said that God has this beautiful way of he both satisfies you and makes you hunger and long for more at the same time. That I have more than enough in you, but I still want more because there is more. That's the invitation. So this is the bread from heaven, and this bread lasts. Jesus says, very truly, I tell you, it's not Moses who has given you the bread from heaven, but it's my Father who gives you the true bread from heaven. For the true bread of God is the bread that comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. And what do they say back? Sir, give us this bread always. See, this is the reality, is that when people hear this invitation, everybody wants it. Everybody wants it. Because what's he saying? You'll never hunger. You'll find lasting joy. You'll be fulfilled. Jesus is describing something that everybody wants and everybody longs for until he makes this radical claim. I am the bread of life. They go, give us this bread always. And Jesus says, I am the bread of life. And they go, Because what do they want? They want their stomachs filled, but they don't want Jesus. Jesus' radical claim, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry. Whoever believes in me will never be thirsty. This is important. I want you guys just for a moment understand that Jesus is a historical person. I think there's so often we read the Bible and we look at it as some kind of book on the shelf, and you forget that this is history, that Jesus was a real human being who came and lived and said these things. Now, I want you to imagine a man. This is the argument they get into right after this. They go, we know where Jesus is from. This was the man who was born in Bethlehem. This is the man who was born to Mary and Joseph. He's from Nazareth. He's from a nothing town. Why are they saying that? Because this man just stood up and said, I'm the bread of life. I will make sure that you never hunger, you never thirst again. Listen, this man is either dangerous, insane, or he's God. These are the three options with someone who makes a claim like this. He's either dangerous, he's insane, or he's God. Jesus looks at these people and says, I am the bread of life. You eat this bread that comes from the Father in heaven, and you will never hunger, you will never thirst. So Jesus basically says, if you give yourself to me, you get a revelation of me, you understand that I am the bread, and you give yourself to me, here's what I want you to know. I give myself to you. This is where Jesus closes out. He begins to talk about his bread being the body, his body being the bread and his blood being the drink that makes sure that you never go hungry and you never thirst again. As Jesus is saying, I am going to give myself fully to you. And you'll see this through the cross, where Jesus takes your sin, he takes my sin, he takes all the things that get in the way of us and God. He takes all of the spoiled bread that we have feasted on in our lives, and he takes it unto himself. He goes to the cross and he says, I will show you how fully I will give myself to you. I will go to the cross, I'll die, and I'll raise again from the dead so that you can know that in me you can find eternal life, because I will hold the keys to death and the grave. He's like, that other bread that you eat, none of that holds that power. That other bread that you eat, none of that has done that for you. That other bread that you eat, it takes from you, but it doesn't give to you. I'm giving myself fully to you. I am the bread of life that's come from heaven, from the Father, for you. And in me only do you have life and life to the full. You give yourself to Jesus when you get a revelation that Jesus has given himself to you. That you are Jesus's joy, delight, and pleasure. And Jesus wants to be your joy, delight, and pleasure. So we'll close here. What qualifies you for this bread? Hunger. That's what qualifies you for this bread. Hunger. Hunger. Desire. Longing. This is what Jesus is telling them. He's like, you keep going to your religious systems. You keep going to these other things because you refuse to acknowledge your hunger. You refuse to say that you're hungry. You refuse to go to the bread that alone can satisfy you and give you life. And what he calls us to do is to actually admit, I am hungry and only you can satisfy me. I've gone to these other things and they cannot satisfy me. I just end up hungry again. I just end up longing for more. It just disappoints me again. It spoils and it doesn't endure. All the place, you keep taking your questions and your longings and your desires to the wrong things, and they don't provide the answers and they don't give you what you need and what you long for. And Jesus is saying, I can answer those questions and I can give you what you long for. But you have to come to me and you have to acknowledge the fact that you're hungry. John Calvin once said this, that the cross is proof that Jesus is willing to go to any length necessary to secure your eternal joy. You want to know what length Jesus is willing to go to satisfy you, to fulfill you, to give you joy, to make you truly, eternally happy in the depths of who you are? You look at the cross. He did that for you. He did that for you. He chose to. And Hebrews goes on to tell us that he did it for the joy that was set before him. What was the joy that was set before him? You. Securing your eternal joy and satisfaction. Accomplishing what the Father had given him to accomplish. You. Redeeming you. Saving you. Loving you. Making a way for you. That's why he's given himself. So, how do we respond to this? Right after this passage, verse 66 tells us that after Jesus preaches this, that many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. That tends to happen when somebody from Nazareth stands up in front of a crowd and says, "You eat my flesh, you drink my blood, and you'll satisfy your soul will be satisfied." They're like, I went to middle school with you, dude. And he's like, "Yep, flesh, blood, come on." By the way, we're gonna receive communion next week, and this will hit on this because Jesus instituted that as kind of a memory and a picture of saying, "I want you to remember what I've done for you." And that's what Jesus is trying to paint for them. He's saying, "I'm doing something for you. You just got to get your eyes up to see who I am, what I really offer, and what I'm really doing for you." And right after this, it says that many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. And then Jesus turns to his 12 and he says, "Are you going to leave me too?" There's moments where just the humanity of Jesus oozes out of the page and it's so beautiful. But all these people walk away after Jesus tells them who he is and what he's done. And he looks at his disciples and he goes, "Are you going to leave too? Are you going to walk away too?" And Peter, as goofy as he can be sometimes, he looks back at Jesus and he says this, "Lord, where are we going to go? Where else are we going to go? You alone have the words of eternal life. And that we have come to believe to know that you are the Holy One of God, that you are who you say you are, and that you can do what you promised to do. They may leave you, they may walk away, but we know that you're the bread of life. We know that you will fully satisfy. We don't understand what you're doing, but we know that whatever the answer is, it's you." And that may be where you're at today. You might not really understand Jesus. You might not really understand the totality of who he is and what he's done, but you have come to the point right now where you can say, "But I do believe that if there's an answer, it's you." And that's where they're at. I don't quite have it all figured out yet, but I know it's you. Whatever it is, it's you. And Jesus makes this amazing promise to us. He says that if you come to him, that he will never turn you away and he will never let you go. That those who are hungry come to him, the bread of life, and he will fill them, he will satisfy them, he will secure them, he will never let them go. Because there's some of you asking yourself, like, "Okay, I come to Jesus, how can I know? How can I trust you?" He's promised us and he's shown us. Listen, there is no one else who has the words of eternal life, and there's nothing else that can satisfy your soul deeply and forever. It's only him. And let me tell you, you can either realize this now, or you can realize this when it's too late and you've run to all kinds of other things that have broken your heart and destroyed your life, or you can just realize it now and turn to him. So as we move into a time of response, I want to kind of give some different prompts. Our prayer, we got some prayer team that's going to come forward to be present to pray. And, you know, this is only our third week, but we're going to have this every single week. Because there's a lot of you, you've gone to church, you've gone to church a lot, and no one's ever prayed for you by name, prayed over you. And I'm going to list out some things for some response, and just come be prayed over. You're not signing your life away. Just come receive prayer from someone who can talk to God with you and on your behalf. So maybe you're here and your soul is hungry. You're just hungry. You're like, yeah, hunger, that describes who I am and where I'm at. You've tasted and you've tried so many things, but they don't satisfy you. And you want something eternal, something that lasts, something that satisfies. Is your soul hungry this morning? Come and receive prayer. Come and be prayed for. Maybe you're here and Jesus tells a story that's often referred to as the prodigal son or the parable of two sons. And maybe you're here and you feel like you're a long way off from God. There's this amazing moment in that passage where the boy who used to be a prince in his father's mansion has now taken all that money and he's wasted his life away and he's in pig slop. And he has this moment, the scriptures literally say that he comes to himself and he goes, what has happened to me? And maybe you're here and you're hearing us talk about how you can settle for less and become less than what you were meant to be. And you are there right now. And this is the moment that you're coming to yourself and you're going, there's more for me. And I want more than this. You can come and you can be prayed for. Because I want you to know that today can be the day you come to Jesus and that no matter who you are, no matter what you've done, no matter where you were last night or who you woke up to this morning, Jesus has paid for your sin. And there is a God who loves you, who can and will save you if you'll only come to him. Or maybe you're here and you used to call yourself a Christian, but you've fallen away and you don't even know what to call yourself anymore. And you've fallen a long way and you've hit the bottom hard. Can I tell you something? That there's room in the heart of God for you. There's room in the heart of God for you. You cannot outsend his grace or outrun his love and you can return today. Or maybe you're here and you're a believer and you've lost your hunger. You remember what it was like to be hungry. You remember what it was like where you encountered Jesus. You saw him, you knew he saw you and you felt love. And you hungered and you thirsted and you longed for him and you missed that. You can come forward today. Just be prayed for, that we could pray that God would give you a fresh revelation of who Jesus is and what he's done. And he would reignite that hunger and that fire and that passion for you again. So Jesus, as we respond, God, I pray that you would stir in this room right now. God, I pray that you would stir in this room. I pray that you would move in hearts right now, God. I pray that there may even be people who, God, I don't care if they have a team member badge on. God, that if they're settling for less than your best, maybe there's things that are hidden that no one knows about. God, you know about those things. You see us for who we are and what we are. You see us for all that we're not. And you love us and you come for us, God. God, I pray that people would just respond and receive prayer this morning, that they would know that there's an invitation on the table to talk to God. And to receive a gift, to receive a blessing from someone else who can talk to you on their behalf, God. God, maybe there's someone in here who wants to put their faith and trust in Jesus, who wants to finally say, I'm hungry and I want you. I don't have all the answers. I don't know what all the details are, but I know that whatever the answer is, you're it, Jesus. God, if that's them, I pray that they would come forward. They would tell us, say, I want to follow Jesus. God, know that we're here to help. God, would you work in this place? Would you move in this room? Would you encounter each and every individual the way that they need to be encountered to give them what they need this morning? Don't let them walk away having left more of you on the table than what they could have had. In Jesus' name, amen.